and thank you everyone for joining in today. My lecture today is actually based on a part of my research for the book. My book came out last year, and it is a part of the OCHS and Routledge series called Archaeology and Religion in South Asia. Through my lecture, I'm going to focus on three main issues: how religious sculptures have been studied and how can they be used to interpret contemporary religious processes, the importance of understanding ritual and architectural context of images, and the whole issue of decontextualization of religious images, that means when they move out of sacred spaces, out of shrines, what happens to their identity and purpose. My study is based on the use of one specific image type, which is called the Uma Maheshwar image, which is Shiv and Parvati, a conjoined sculpture of Shiv and Parvati. And my area of study is Eastern India and the modern day state of Bihar in Eastern India. I will begin by introducing the Uma Maheshwar icon, the geographical region, the chronological time period under discussion. And this will be followed by a broad survey of how religious sculptures have been considered in recent historiography. And I will finally move on to the main issues under discussion. This is an example of the Uma Maheshwar image. The classic Uma Maheshwar image shows Shiv and Uma, Parvati, seated together on the same pedestal, caught in an intimate embrace. While Shiv may be seated on a stone cushion or on a lotus throne, Parvati sits on Shiv's lap or on his thighs. Parvati is always shown with two arms, while Shiv may have two, four, or even more arms. We have examples where Shiv has as many as 18 arms in this particular image variety. And these images are not just confined to Eastern India, but they are found all over North India, in Central India, as well as in South India. Shiv is usually depicted as taller than Parvati, and Parvati in some images is very small, almost childlike. They are both surrounded by a halo, heavily bedecked in jewelry, and carry different weapons and ornaments in their arms. Often they are portrayed with their animal vehicles, the vahans, the tiger in case of Parvati, and the Nandi bull in case of Shiv. And there are other deities of the Shaiv pantheon like Ganesh and Skand who are also portrayed. And sometimes even small images of devotees appear on the sculpture. The image represents cosmic procreation as well as the synthesis of two powerful independent deities. The region under consideration is the present-day state of Bihar in Eastern India. In my first round of survey, I found as many as 80 Uma Maheshwar images in the region, with the largest area of concentration being the area of South Bihar. So you can see Bihar on the map of India. And in this larger map, the grey area is the area which I have taken under consideration. So this is the southern part of the state of Bihar. What is striking about the region is that it is usually seen as the heartland of Buddhism, with Bodh Gaya and Nalanda being the two premier Buddhist centers. And these are also two UNESCO World Heritage Sites which have been listed for their Buddhist remains. Two other early fairly sacred centers in the region are Rajgir and Pavapuri. I think you can see it on the map. I don't have a pointer. But what is important about Rajgir and Pavapuri is that they are Jain pilgrimage centers, and Jain pilgrims from all over India come to visit here. The city of Gaya, which is a Vaishnav center, which contains the Vishnubad temple, and is also associated with the Shraddh rite, the rites of paying homage to ancestors, is also located here. Having said that, having talked about the multiplicity of religion found in this region, the presence of Uma Maheshwar icons in large numbers also indicate a strong Shaiv presence. And subsequently, over the years, I have uncovered more than 150 Uma Maheshwar sculptures from this region alone. The largest number of Uma Maheshwar sculptures can be dated between the 9th and the 12th centuries, but Uma Maheshwar images in the area, they start appearing as early as the 6th, 7th century. Uma Maheshwar sculptures from Bihar are available in a variety of stones such as granite, sandstone, and the most common is black basalt, which is used for these sculptures. There are also images available in bronze and in Ashtadhatu, which is the ritually prescribed alloy of eight metals. On tabulation and closer examination of the image type, I could also see immense variation within the region in the style of Uma Maheshwar images, which means that the hands of Shiv and Parvati can be differently placed, the bodily postures are different, the facial expressions are different, the back slabs are different, the placement of legs are different. So within this image type, there is immense variation in the region. Gopinath Rao's Elements of Hindu Iconography, first published in 1914, is perhaps one of the earliest treatises on Hindu iconography written by an Indian scholar. In this comprehensive four-volume series, Gopinath Rao carried a diligent search into the beginnings of image worship in India, outlining the meanings, symbols, mythology, and physical description of Hindu sculptures. He argued that texts existed before images were made and that texts prescribed the norms for making these images. With this presupposition, he took up various categories of sculptures, and these include Vaishnav, Shaiv, and Shakta sculptures. He mentioned the textual prescription of each image type and found and substantiated them with their mythology and with actual images from different regions of India. So he found textual prescriptions, and he tried to match them with actual images which were found. By doing so, he resorted to a one-to-one comparison between texts and sculptures, and images became merely illustrative of the surviving texts. However, archaeological records from several sites indicate otherwise. Religious sculptures begin to appear in South Asia much before textual descriptions were actually canonized. For instance, from the south of Mathura, which is near modern-day Delhi, images can be found as early as the beginning of the Common Era. Gopinath Rao, though engaged with the physical descriptions of images, he failed to dwell with the emotion and the theological prescriptions. He viewed sculptures as freestanding and devoid of any architectural setting, and he was unable to connect religious iconography with the layout of Hindu temples. His seminal work, however, established the patterns within which successive generations of art historians and students of iconometrics have worked. The foremost problem is whether sculptures are representative of texts and mythology, such that religious texts are read and available sculptural types are categorized to fit within the different mythologies. A second trend has been the art historical approach, where scholars look at the aesthetic value of sculptures and how close are the physical attributes, how closely can they match with texts. And a third way of looking at it is the chronological evolution of images on the basis of style, which looks at the mudras, the rasa, and the emblems which deities hold in their hands. There are several challenges with this approach, where religious sculptures are seen isolated and decontextualized of their ritual and architectural background. The foremost being that it does not explain the purpose of these images, nor gives an idea of the contemporary historical processes when they were produced. My methodology is a little bit different from what I have described so far. I have used religious sculptures as the main source of historical investigation and studied them without comparison to text, as is the general norm. By highlighting the architectural placement and ritual use of images, I will enter the shrines which the Uma Maheshwar images had inhabited during different spates of their lives, and I'll draw out patterns of larger religious processes in the area. Looking at the images, if you've looked at some of the slides I have shown, it is obvious that these images were once part of temple complexes, and they were both placed inside and on the outside walls of the sanctum, on doorways and on pillars. We have some pillar remains which have Uma Maheshwar images carved out on them. At this point, I went back to my tabulation of data, and I found that at present, while a large number of these images are in shrines, many of them are in museums, both in India and outside India. And a large of part of these images are still under worship. So they are actually in temples and under worship. Some of the images in museums and private collections have been catalogued. Some of them have also been published. While one tends to think of museums as a homogeneous category, my experience has taught me otherwise. There are many kinds of museums, and there are many strategies adopted to build museum collections and to cater to a variety of audience and provide different strategies of exhibition and display. This is an issue I'll come back to later. This is just a list of just a few museums where I could find my Uma Maheshwar sculptures from Bihar. What is both fascinating and astounding to see is how religious sculptures from the remotest of villages and sites of South Bihar, and not just South Bihar, but also many, many sites in South Asia, how images have traveled to museums and private collections across the globe, mostly in the name of conservation and preservation, but sometimes with no record of their original context or provenance. So they are just listed by their names and there is no context, no provenance attached to them. This is just one half of the story. On reading excavation reports, going through photo archives and online resources, I found that a large number of Uma Maheshwar images were still at sites and in worship, in temples, and some even in domestic shrines. I started to wonder that if there are so many surviving Uma Maheshwar images, where are the temples where they were once located? Based on my sculptural data and mapping the temples in the region, a very different picture began to emerge. The region of South Bihar is dotted with some fairly early shrines. This is the slide of Barabar Hill Caves. These are one of the oldest shrines in the region and also in India. These are rock-cut cave temples, which can be dated to the 2nd-3rd century BCE. And as per inscriptions found at the site, they were donated to the Ajivika sect by King Ashok and his grandson Dashrath. Freestanding Hindu, Buddhist and Jain temples began to appear in the region from about the 5th, 6th centuries of the present era. These were single-room brick temples, the walls of which were later came to be embellished with stone sculptures. So they were simple one-room brick shrines and these were all mud bricks and they were plain-walled. Later on, sculptures were added to these. The religious landscape of the area at present, however, looks very different. The region is dotted with modern structures made in brick, concrete, and sometimes even glazed with ceramic tiles. The temples are fairly new, made in the last 50 years or so. However, the sculptures in the temple, both inside the sanctum and those on the outside walls, are much older and can be dated to from the 9th to 13th centuries. Some temples also had the original sanctum intact and made of stone, or sometimes even in the case of a cave temple, the original cave existed around which the modern temples were constructed. So as you can see in this image, it's hard to visualize, but it was originally a square brick sanctum around which later projections were made. And this is what the temple, so this is a 5th century temple, but this is what it looks after conservation. The image on the right side is a present day image. What is also interesting to see that this was originally a sun temple, which later was transformed into a Vishnu temple, and now it is a Shaiv temple. This is another modern day temple. As you can see, this has been constructed on a mound, and within the mound there are remains of brick structures as well as sculptures. Again, the temple is new, but the sculptures lined up outside, as you can see, they are much older. Inside, this is a Shaiv temple, as you can see from the snake on the shikhar. Inside this is a 9th century Shivlinga. And on the inside walls, I was not allowed to photograph inside, but on the inside walls, there's a sculpture of Parvati on one wall and there's a sculpture of Uma Maheshwar on the other wall. Though the temples are all recent, the pujaris, the priests, and at many places, even the villagers, have a historical memory of the original shrine, the origin myths of the temple, and how the older shrine collapsed but was renovated and expanded upon into new structures. However, even when the shrines were rebuilt and reorganized, the same space continued to be reused and held sacred, and the same sculptures came to be re-enshrined. These are some of the modern day temples which contain Uma Maheshwar sculptures. I found many more Uma Maheshwar images to add to my data and which had been reused in these modern temples. The Uma Maheshwar image is almost never the principal image of the sanctum. It is used mostly for ornamentation on temple walls, where the principal object of worship is the Shivalinga. Uma Maheshwar images are also placed on the side walls of the sanctum to embody the manifest rupa of Shiv, who is present in the form of a linga. And in the third instance, the Uma Maheshwar images are also placed at the entrance of the sanctum. Apart from the story of Uma Maheshwar images, several other stories began to emerge from the sites. And what is very interesting that is that Uma Maheshwar image is also found at several Buddhist sites, including at Nalanda and Bodh Gaya. What was also remarkable to observe and which added greatly to my discourse is that the shrines and devotees in the region do not differentiate between Buddhist, Jain and Hindu icons. The same icon can have multiple identities. For instance, and this is very common, that an Avalokiteshvara image is now enshrined and worshipped as a Surya image or even as Vishnu. And small votive stupas are enshrined as Linga and worshipped as in the form of Shiv. Hence, the identity of an image is not fixed. And if we move away from the academic discourse, the same image when placed in different contexts can be understood in varied ways. I'm sorry, the slide is not very clear, but why I really like this slide is that this tree shrine is actually from the Mahabodhi temple complex. So this these images under the tree are behind the Mahabodhi temple. And as you can see, there is a Ganesh, there is a Vishnu, and there is Uma Maheshwar. And these are all present in what is typically considered a Buddhist complex. What is also interesting is that neither is the sacred space in the region categorized as Buddhist, Hindu or Jain. The same temple contains icons of Hindu deities along with Buddhist and Jain icons, and they are all duly anointed and worshipped in the Hindu manner. This image here is, as we will call him, he's a Buddha image. This is again next to the Nalanda monastery. This Buddha here in the village is called Telia Baba. And he is worshipped as Bhairav, who is a form of Shiva. So for the Hindu villagers, this Buddha is worshipped as Bhairav, a form of Shiva. But for Thai pilgrims who come to this region very frequently, he is the Black Buddha. And this Buddha has magical powers of healing, and he is offered and smeared with oil. Tel basically means oil in Hindi. So he is smeared with oil because of his magical properties of healing sickness. The point I'm trying to make is that if we shift our focus from looking at the physical attributes of a sacred image, a lot more complexities and identities begin to emerge. The changing architectural context of religious images is hence very important to understand the nature and identity of religious icons, as well as the purpose behind making it. It helps us to visualize the original religious landscape of the region, the long-term usage of shrines and how sacred space is organized today. These are images from a temple in Nalanda. This is a shrine of dedicated to Surya, the sun god. And as you can see, there are many Buddhist images which are also worshipped here. And there are some temple remains which have also been enshrined and they are worshipped. As in the case of the South Bihar region, the original mud brick shrines, which I had mentioned earlier, they probably started to collapse by the 8th, 9th centuries to be replaced by more elaborate structures. So I'm just going to talk about the changing religious landscape. So the original shrines collapsed and these were replaced by new temples. The new temples were made in stone. They also had stone sculptures which ornamented the walls. Once the oldest temples started collapsing or they were renovated, the stone sculptures continued to be reused. By the 8th, 9th century, we have very elaborate temple complexes and the original single room shrines now came to be surrounded by smaller subsidiary shrines which would house the avatars of the main deity. So in case the main principal image was dedicated to Vishnu, then the avatars and the family of Vishnu would be in the subsidiary shrines. The whole temple complex also developed with tanks, houses for priests, walls and elaborate gateways. With so many newer structures, there was also a need for more images to be produced. And by the 11th, 12th centuries, stone sculptures came to be produced in very large numbers in South Bihar. Through the use of Uma Maheshwar image and its changing architectural placement, I have attempted to bring out this changing religious landscape and the transformations that religious images undergo because of their changing architectural context. Every time the temples were rebuilt and images were removed and reconsecrated, they came to acquire new meanings and identities. This slide which I show, it's personally, I really enjoy looking at this slide because these are all sculptures which have probably been abandoned. They are found on the side of the tank, and as you can see, people are drying their clothes around it. But what is interesting is that the sacred power of the image has not gone away. It is still enshrined and it is still worshipped, though in a different way, not as it would be in a temple. Analysis of my corpus of sculptures also brings out the several layers of negotiation and accommodations between different religions and how the Uma Maheshwar motif was absorbed by each of these. By using iconography, I have explored how through a process of synthesis and absorption, Shaivism and Buddhism in the region became accommodative of the marginal divinities and a melange of local traditions. I have hence attempted to move away from the evolutionary history and understand religious reconfiguration and amalgamations in a select geographical area. In this process of temple reorganization, so far I've only talked about the process till the 12th, 13th century, but in this process of temple reorganization, an important period which is often neglected is the historical discourse in the 19th and the 20th century. So this was the time when when India was colonized by the British, and British officers and scholars began to explore the area. This saw the beginning of archaeological explorations and survey in the region of Bihar, when colonial officers visited various old temples, listed the archaeological remains, and provided formal labels and nomenclatures. During this process, temple sites were once again reorganized in the name of conservation, and religious sculptures were once again dislocated. The colonial discourse on sacred sites, shrines, and icons from South Bihar created certain religious categories, names, and identities, and most importantly, fixed permanent religious categories within which to view them. So a shrine could now only be either Buddhist or Hindu. There was no sharing of space, because that is how the British historians read the sites. The identities established through colonial archaeology and centuries of knowledge production continue to define the paradigms within which we still view these religious sculptures and shrines. Another simultaneous process which was happening during this period of rediscovery was that a large number of images were moved into museums and private collections to lose their sacred identity and came to be viewed as art objects from India. While the colonial officers travelled in the region, they carried out amateur archaeological excavations, made collections, and established personal and private museums. But by removing icons and antiquities into museums, not only did they lose their sacred identities, but marked a significant break in history and the loss of crucial archaeological evidence. Finally, by tracing the afterlife of Uma Maheshwar sculptures, I have tried to enter the shrines where they were originally placed. The life of a religious sculpture for me is not fixed at the moment of its fabrication, but is constantly redefined by its ritual and architectural placement and by the community of worshippers it interacts with. The biographies of shrines and religious icons that I have sketched trace the long-term usage of shrines and sculptures. By studying the evolution of the Uma Maheshwar motif over the course of 7 centuries or more and its changing architectural placement, I have tried to bring about the accompanying modification in religious idiom, rituals and configuration of shrines, as well as other sacred landmarks in the region. Through my work, I have attempted to find a context to religious iconography by understanding them as an intrinsic feature of sacred architecture. I have traced how their architectural context, meaning and purpose have changed through history. Religious icons, moreover, do not depict a certain moment of religious encounter, but a whole gamut of experiences. Museums provide fixed meanings to sculptures through fixed narratives of display and exhibition, which are artificially created around them. To overcome this narrow interpretation, it is crucial that religious iconography is understood within the religious landscape for which it was originally created. Thank you.